Okay, so apparently we're going to continue with this today also. I don't have the screen working. Any questions before we start? It's too easy now, right? Not too much happening. Okay. So last time we were talking about the need to deal with precision and recall as the ways of evaluating whether or not information retrieval systems are working well. Can anybody tell me why we need precision and recall kind of studies? As again, it's just speed.
It's not really competing. If you can, because if you can always achieve a perfect value of one of the criteria with as price of the other.
So if we are doing databases, let's say database style retrieval, then what happens? What is supposed to be the precision? What is supposed to be the recall in normal databases? What? Say it loud. 100% precision and 100% recall. Okay. And to call yourself a traditional database retrieval system, you must provide 100% precision, 100% recall. Since everybody provides that, there's no point in talking about precision and recall anymore. Okay, and so you talk about who is faster. Okay, furthermore, another interesting thing in databases versus information retrieval is can the program decide before outputting a result whether or not it's going to be an answer for the query? In what? In databases. Can it be the case for information retrieval? Does your program that you're trying to write, the information retrieval system, can it guarantee that the result it is giving out is actually going to be a result? No. That is the most important thing. So in some sense, the judge for your system is not within the system. So you have to generate and have it tested. Okay. The hope is that whatever is going to be done by the tester, the user, is somehow taken into account while generating. That's the spot that we spent a lot of time talking about last time. In essence, what we are trying to do in the information retrieval is to sort of figure out the relevance function of the user, and with respect to that relevance function, in fact, the relevance function isn't even this. We mentioned when we were talking about the marginal relevance that really you have to talk about the relevance of a document D with respect to the given query Q, the user U, and the documents D1 to DI minus 1 that they have seen until now. Because the relevance of a document depends not only on the user and on the query, but also on how many of the same sorts of documents have you seen before. Okay, so in essence, you're trying to learn this. If somebody gives this to you beforehand, then information retrieval is database management. Okay, what's going on is you're trying to guess this as well as use this. So there is sort of a learning going on. Most traditional information retrieval systems don't learn. In fact, we mentioned this last time. Actually, we'll get to this in a minute, but what happened to my... In trying to learn the relevance function, you could learn, actually, or you could try to make up the user's mind. You can combine those kinds of ideas. I'll use it to heck with it. I will decide what is relevant. And hopefully enough people will like me for that. Yes, sir. Yeah, but there are multiple ways. First of all, again, when we are discussing this, point one is that we are talking about traditional information retrieval systems. So in general, there are systems which can actually ask you, you know, and more importantly, you can do this indirectly. If you click on a result, then potentially, you know, in fact, in search engines, since you brought up search engines, all the current search engines are continually trying to improve their ranking, and the way they do it is they see which of the results do you click, okay, and they are able to keep track of that measure and then use that, you know, sort of a indirect way.
But a click doesn't necessarily
get it. It's better than nothing. right? Right. So it's like, you know, imagine you're trying to sell a used car, right? And somebody comes in and you don't really know what they're looking for. You can wait until they make it extremely clear what they're looking for, and your colleague would get the actual sale. Okay, you have to essentially, just based on the fact that they seem to look longingly towards one direction, you should assume, because that's better than when they walked in. So you're right that you can never be sure other than lobotomizing. And in fact, one of the interesting discussions we had here is, even if you lobotomize people, you still may not know what they were really looking for, because sometimes the user may not know what they're looking for to begin with, right? Okay, so then we were talking about precision and recall with respect to the ground truth, which is what the user essentially likes, okay? And so after, if you designed a system which ranks the results and gives it to the user, and then you can talk about if there are two systems, which is better, okay? And you think of it in terms of precision and recall. Precision is, in essence, the percentage of results that you return that are actually relevant to the user. And recall is the percentage of relevant results that you return. And they're both important, okay? And in general, so if you have precision on one axis, recall on other axis. In fact, if I just take, you know, if I give you a huge number of results up front, then you can just talk about the precision and recall that for that whole set. Okay, you can also, what you can do more usefully is this, which is you can talk about precision recall curves, which is, since you don't give the entire set of results at once, you give them in a ranked fashion. And since you do know that when you put a ranking, when I say you the information retrieval program, when you put them in a rank, normally people look at it in that ranked order, okay? So the question then is, you can talk about, so for example, here is a search engine which returned for some query the following results, D1, D2, D3, D4, blah, 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 and all the things in blue happen to be relevant to the user. By the way, here there's a model I'm using which is binary relevance, that is, either it's relevant or it's not relevant. We can actually extend it to talk about degrees of relevance, but let's just assume binary relevance. Okay, so these are all the blue ones are the relevant ones. Okay, now clearly you can see that a better system, so it turns out in this case, and these are the only relevant ones, it turns out, okay? That means you know how many total answers are there for the query to begin with. Okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There are only 10 results that would ever be relevant to the user, okay? The best system would have actually shown those 10 results first and all the other junk later. And in fact, better yet, just shut your mouth after the first 10 results, okay? Now in this case, you can talk about the precision and recall for this system as the results are being output. So with respect to a percentage recall, for each level of recall, how much is the precision? Okay, I already mentioned that if you don't speak at all, in essence, you are infinitely precise. I mean, not infinitely, fully precise, because you haven't said anything wrong yet. Okay, so you assume that for zero recall, precision is one. Okay, and then normally they basically talk about, you know, you're basically plotting the recall here and precision here. And in the IR community, they talk about this 11-point curve. All that means is you plot 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, all the way up to 1.0 recall. Okay, for each of those recalls, what is the precision? When you got that much recall, what was the precision? Okay, and in this data, for example, look at the 0.2. When the 0.2 recall occurred, you get 0.2 recall by this time, right? Because you have returned 2 of the 10 results. You understand there are 10 blue ones and 2 results were returned, so 2 of the 10, so 0.2 recall. And by the time you returned this, now you have returned 3 results by now, of which 2 were relevant. So the precision is 2/3. Okay? Yes?
So, precision is 1 when recall 0. So if you don't say anything, you haven't said anything wrong yet. Can, when recall is 1, so if you return everything, does that mean the precision has to be 0?
What? When? 1?
When recall is 1.
Yeah. No, it is not, because if you essentially give all the, in this particular case, as I said, if you only show all the blue ones and nothing more, you stop talking afterwards, then you got 100% recall, 100% precision. Okay? You can increase recall trivially by just continuing to talk. But by stopping to talk, you made sure that when you got 100% recall, you also got 100% precision. Okay? So here, that's the reason why at point 2, the precision is 2 over 3. Okay? And similarly, for point 3 recall, it happens at the 6th document. By that time, you know, 3 by 6, so recall is 0.5. In general, if precision, you know, in general, what's happening is, normal way it happens is, as the recall increases, precision struggles to keep pace. Okay, as you keep talking, you're more likely than not to fall down in precision. Okay, so here's my question. If it turned out that I told the system exactly what the user was looking for in terms of the relevance metric, so in some sense, IR then becomes database. Okay, what would have been its precision recall curve like? Straight line, okay, but lots of straight lines, that's also a straight line, but you mean that, right? Okay, so the best precision recall curve you can ever get is that, okay, do you understand? And anything else is below it, okay? So if you have two systems, then what you can talk about is, if you have two systems and if you draw the precision recall curves for them, they essentially have all the information to compare them. So for example, the orange colored one here corresponds to one system, and this black one corresponds to another system. Which is better? If you have to pick one of them, and I've already tested, and this is the precision recall results, which one would you pick? The one which has higher precision for every recall value, right? So you would pick this. Okay, that's nice part. And similarly, of course, if you had that would have been always winning, and you would have picked that. What's more interesting is these two, the orange and the blue one. Neither is always dominating the other. So now, which one would we pick when? So for example, are there conditions under which I would pick method one rather than method two? Method one rather than method two. So if I'm going to, this is meant for the web search. These information retrieval engines were meant for web search. Which would you pick? The orange one or the blue one? Why? Normal web search. First page. So one of the big things that you have already figured out just by looking at yourself is you never see beyond the first page. Now this is not by no means obvious, okay? What's interesting is, how many of you have heard of a search engine called InfoSeek? Yes, so he's old enough. He too is old enough. They can take classes like this. But anyway, InfoSeek, just about 5-6 years back, maybe in fact 10 years back, I think, you know, there used to be too many search engines, and they were like so out of it, they were so clueless, that InfoSeek would show the top 10 results and say, if you pay me this much money, I will show you up to 3,000 results. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's like, you know, if you showed me the bottom 10 results, and you said, if you pay me, I will show you the top 10 results, I can understand, right? The assumption that InfoSeek had, this is its business model, and clearly you don't have InfoSeek anymore. and the business model that they had is, I'll show you the top 10 results, but if you really want all the other ones, right? And you'll only want it if you're like a private investigator, or you're trying to do some search on, you know, Sarah Palin's, you know, life or something. That's the only reason you would need all possible results. Okay, most of the time you're looking for a high precision at low recall. Okay, that's the big thing. In fact, this is the difference between normal traditional information retrieval and web search. And as somebody was pointing out, by web search, we mean the majority web search made by majority bozos like us. Okay, but you know, if you're a private investigator and you're trying to dig dirt on somebody, you want, for example, the one which has higher precision, even at very far away recall. Okay, that's the basic thing. So the point is, precision recall curves are giving you information to decide which is useful when. And then for web search engines, obviously, the ones which have high precision at the low recalls are much more useful. Okay? Now, if you have, since you have two methods, two approaches here, so the two points, you know, precision and recall, sometimes people want one single number, you can combine them. If you have apples and oranges, you want to combine. In fact, we combine apples and oranges many, many times in this course, okay? And most of the time without much of a principle behind combination. In fact, the combination of page rank and similarity, which we'll be doing, and most of you probably are aware of, is completely unprincipled, okay? But here, if you want to combine precision and recall into one measure, you know, maybe you should take some sort of a average, okay? The usual thing to say, of course, is there are multiple types of averages. One thing you can at least say is, if I have a system which has 0.5 precision, 0.5 recall, another which has one precision, zero recall, and another one which has zero precision, one recall. Okay. Clearly, to do these two systems, you don't need a computer science degree. And you don't need any degrees, really. Okay. To get one precision, zero recall, write a program which doesn't output anything. Okay, and to do this, write a program which gives the entire database, entire document set. Okay, clearly this requires some non-trivial intelligence to actually do an, you know, in retrieval system which has a reasonable precision and recall. You want your average measure to not say all three are equally good, right? Because if you say all three are equally good, then you're losing the point, okay? So one of the averages, which actually, if you have two entities, you're taking average between them, harmonic mean, it has the useful property that it's high only when both are high, okay? So normally you define this thing called F measure, which is essentially a harmonic mean between precision and recall, okay? So for 0.5, for example, you know, both being 0.5, the F measure would be 0.5. If one is 0.5 and one is 0 and one is 1, F measure would be 0, saying that you're useless. I mean, anybody could have written it. And there are variations of this measure where you can try to provide higher weight to precision or higher weight to recall. So weighted harmonic mean. Okay, these are useful in as much as if you want a single measure to describe, you know, compare two systems. Really, the best way to compare systems is like this. You look at the entire precision recall curve, and you know they have advantages at different regions. But if you need one, you know, this is the way you can do it. Okay. So as I said, if you have a choice between precision and recall in the web, you always go for precision. At least the general web search, because people are, you know, more interested in the top few results than in going through all the results. Okay. But there are situations, as I said, if you are a private investigator or if you are a medical practitioner who's trying to find any papers written on this following kind of condition that your patient has, you know, it may well be that there is one paper which doesn't come up high enough, but it's there somewhere and you want to look at all of them to look for the right paper. Okay. Now, so there is a way, if you go ahead and develop information retrieval systems, there is a way in which you can compare them in terms of precision and recall. Okay. Now, the question, of course, is there are competitions right now. I mean, for a long time, there have been competitions in the information retrieval conference called the TREC conference, text retrieval competitions. All they do is compare your system against somebody else's system on the same set of queries and the same set of documents. Okay. Now, one thing, of course, is it is not enough to just have queries and documents to run this competition. You also need relevance judgments. The problem with the relevance judgments is they are not at all universal, right? For the same query, some people will think these documents are relevant. Somebody might say, oh, no, this is not really relevant. Okay. So, TREC is run, of course, required. To run TREC competition, you need prior relevance judgment. What did they do? They essentially went and talked to some random people and decided for every benchmark, there is a benchmark set of documents, a benchmark set of queries. For every query, for every document, they have made these people say, yes, it's relevant, no, it's not relevant. Okay? And that is the information that's actually available to them. And then they can use that to compare your search engine's performance to the gold standard. Now, of course, this gold standard is not particularly gold because it depends on who are the people who did this ranking. Okay. To the extent most humans are somewhat similar in these relevance judgments, you're okay. Otherwise, you are in trouble. Okay. But this is something. This is just part of the problem of doing information retrieval, because relevance is very much specific to the query, the set of answers, as well as the user. And what's relevant to me is not relevant to you necessarily. Okay. But there is an annual competition called TREC, which is run in Information Retrieval Conference, where they have a variety of document corpora, the newswire documents, bioinformatics documents, and so on and so forth. For each of them, they have queries, you know, canned queries, and for those canned queries, they know the answers. Okay? And so then they can compare the system's performance in terms of precision and recall using those. Okay. So imagine I'm trying to test you, except these are not objective type questions. They have A, B, C, D, E, but they are basically the answers. There is no obviously correct answer, you know. So there are subjective judgments involved, and I decided what's the right answer, and I'm going to test you with respect to that. That's what's going to happen. Okay. But so it's very much benchmark driven, and it's very much so if you in fact overfit to the track, you may still lose out in the real world. Okay, there is no actual evidence to actually suggest this, but if you develop information retrieval systems which are extremely good on track competition data, that means they're extremely good for those bozos who gave the relevance judgments for the track data. They could be their best search engine, but if there's only one of them and a billion of you who are searching, and they're all very different from his judgment, you're not going to do as well. Okay, that's the point I'm trying to make. Okay, so this, all of this is before we actually start developing information retrieval system. You need to figure out if you're done. Will you know you're done? And how will you test how good it is? That's all we did till now. So I didn't tell you how to rank. I didn't tell you how to design an information retrieval system such that it'll do a reasonable ranking. I just said if it were to do ranking, I mean, if it were to output documents and saying these are relevant, I mean, and then you can compare them to ground truth and talk about their precision and recall. That's what we did till now. Okay. So now we'll go back and start looking at some ranking methods, in the traditional ranking methods in the information retrieval. And based on the last class discussion, some of which will be repeated today, you should not be surprised that none of these are foolproof. For every possible idea, you can come up with a way of defeating it. Okay? It's just a question of, when I say something seems to work well, it's mostly saying they seem to work well on the track competitions, or that enough people are using it still. Okay? So now, how do normal retrieval systems, that, you know, traditional IR systems work? They have basically a bunch of text documents, okay, and they are essentially going to take these documents and do some operations on them, called text operations, that involve things like stemming words. So if they say used, they convert into use, okay, so that there will be fewer variants of the same word. And they can do noun phrase detection, such that if there's a data, the word data and a word structure, they can realize that it's a data structure. It's one word, really, one phrase, okay? And you can also remove stop words, words which are like present too often in every place, so they're really not supposed to make sense in indexing. And do that, after that, from the text operations, they try to find what's the set of words or noun phrases that are worth indexing over. Okay, this is the normal IR. Okay, so somehow there is a human coming into the loop. Okay, and you pick up the index terms, and with respect to them, you index the documents. Okay, and then when there is a query, you on the query too, you do the same sort of text operations. Okay, so much so that if you say, give me used cars, it really is looking for used car, not used cars, because S is gone and ED is gone. Okay. And then you compare them, and then one of the things that we'll talk about later is that queries, sometimes you try to do some operations on the query to expand the context of the query. So for example, you might try to add to the query terms other terms that are synonymous with them. Or you can ask the user, would you like to add the following extra terms? Okay? whatever, after you got the queries, then you essentially compare the query terms with the document terms and rank the documents. That's what happens. Okay, and then most of what we'll be doing today is, you know, two methods for ranking. One is Boolean and one is vector space. Vector space is pretty widely used. Okay, but we'll get there in a minute. So now the interesting aspects, of course, are if you have a large enough data set of documents, you know, efficient indexing and retrieval is important. Okay, since retrieval you have very little time, you need to index efficiently, you know, intelligently to begin with, so that you can get things out very fast. Okay, so I will show you one slide about, you know, inverted indices. This is not the only thing we talk about indexes. In fact, indexes, as I mentioned last time, are like a huge big deal about efficient search engine development. But we'll mention this at least at this point, and we'll come back maybe a couple of weeks later and talk about more complex indexing mechanisms, you know, which also, for example, will look for near misses for words if you mistype them and so on. Okay, so all you're doing, you know, the main idea in these files is inverted indices, which essentially says for every word, what are the documents that that contain that word, and what are the positions in those documents where that word is present. That's all you want. Okay, you have a, you know, if you have a bunch of text, then you tokenize the text. You essentially look for the words in each of the documents and say you have these many copies of this word, these many copies of this word in each of these documents. And then that's for individual documents. And then you have one single inverted index which says here are all the list of words that are present in any possible document in my corpus. It's a dictionary of documents. It's a vocabulary for me. Okay, and for each of these words, this one tells me what are the number of documents that contain that word, and the total number of times that word is present, and then you throw in something called a postings list, which essentially says, okay, here is the first occurrence of it. It's in the document 1, position 7, document 1, position 9, and then document 10, position 4, and so on. Okay. You can compute this. I mean, there are efficient ways of making this index, but you can make it once, and one of the advantages of this is once you make it, it clearly avoids, you now look into the worst thing you can do in retrieval is to look at each document and see is this relevant to the query, because then you would be doing work that's proportional to the size of the document corpus. What you want is to do work that's proportional to the size of the query. And that's what inverted index is helping you do. Okay? If you do this work beforehand, then at the query time, you only need to look at the words, and for each word, you know which documents they're present in. And as long as you're looking at words that are not present in all documents, okay, which in fact, if a word is present in every document, then it's actually a useless word and you're likely to remove it anyway. That's the stop word. Okay, so in general, a word is present in just a very small subset of the documents. Okay, and then so you are only comparing them. You know, you're basically intersecting the documents that contain this keyword. I intersect that with the documents that also contain the second keyword. You already have a smaller set again. And then that's your candidate set of documents. You're trying to rank them. Okay. We will get to this later, the indexes, but you know, keep the inverted indices in mind. That's what we assume as the minimum idea for indexing documents. Okay, and in fact, I believe, if I remember correctly, the first project we give you the inverted indices, I think already, and then you were only asked to do it for retrieval using the ranking method. But actually, we already construct it for you. Okay. So I mentioned text operations here, and then let me give you a little idea of text operations. Again, each of these you can spend a lot of time, but for now I want to get quickly to the ranking, partly because, as you will see after this slide, that most search engines don't do text operations anyway. Okay, so in fact we'll talk about why that makes sense, but you know, we'll see what text operations are supposed to be. So you start with the document, you consider the punctuation and the accents and spacing, etc. Then you look for the stop words. These are words that the designer said are too common, so don't index on them. Okay, things like articles, the all those things can be removed. Okay, then you look for noun groups, which are again these are words that the designer in the traditional information retrieval said these are groups of words next to each other that mean something more than just each word separately. So data is different, structure is different, data structure is a completely different concept. So you look for this kind of noun groups. Then stemming is essentially if you have a, you know, again this part, by the way, in, you know, is very much language specific. I have to assume that we're talking only about English mostly, okay? And these kind of syntactic operations can be different for other languages. So for stemming, in English you have these words, verbs will have all sorts of endings, and then there is really a root verb, and what you want to do is just remember the root verb and then cut all the variations. Okay, now you might say, what if I'm really interested in used cars, not used car? Tough luck for you. That's what basically information retrieval tells you. What if you went to the Tempe library, you know, and then you decided to search for a keyword that you made up in the card catalog? It won't be there because they didn't index things on that. Okay? So then after that, you know, you have basically stemmed words and noun phrases, and some of the words have been removed because they're too common, and then you take a subset of them and you manually index documents with respect to them. This is what happens in the traditional retrieval, traditional IR system design. Okay? Of these things, the interesting, one interesting thing is stemming. You really need one guy to do it. You know, English is not, you know, it's crazy enough when you start learning it, but it does have certain regularities, and there's a set of rules that you can follow to stem words correctly. Okay? And this guy called Porter wrote one, Porter Stemmer, and it's a bunch of rules, and it just basically goes through a procedure, and then it stems the words for you, and it does it mostly right. And everybody uses it. Okay? I won't discuss, I mean, basically, it does things like binarization will become binarized. Okay, and it does totally syntactic analysis in terms of looking for Asian, okay, R-T-I-O-N as the end, and then remove the T-I-O-N, and what it would like to do is say binarize the, and then it realizes that you can't end with an A, and it puts an E. Okay, so that's what it's doing mostly, and there is a, you know, you can download the Porter Stemmer, and you can stem your English language yourself. Okay. And this is something that's very language specific. It's different for different languages, obviously. Okay. What will be most interesting is actually German, right? I mean, for those of you who know German or Sanskrit, which are two other languages, you know, there are many, many languages. In German, you can combine large number of words together into a super word. Okay. In Sanskrit, you can do the same thing. Okay, these are called samasas in Sanskrit, and German, I don't know what they are called, these are super words. And, you know, people make fun of it. If you want to do a skit on German, then, you know, German code word would take 2 days to just say it, because it's a really long code word. But anyway, so it will be very interesting in those kinds of cases. The stemming is also separating the words into pieces, because you combined all the words, glued them together. You need to split them into pieces. Because otherwise, what you're storing are huge noun phrases, which if they have some significance, it's one thing. But if it's just because people wanted to put it together in this sentence, you are then remembering grams, n-grams, rather than shingles, rather than noun phrase. The difference between shingle and a noun phrase is shingle is any consecutive K words. Any consecutive K words is a K shingle. Okay? Maybe they'll only occur together in that sentence, never again. Okay, and a K shingle is a K noun phrase if in fact those K words seem to occur together pretty much all the time, or large number of times. Okay, data structure is a two shingle, which is also a two noun phrase. Okay. Okay, so that's about stemming, and they also in normal retrieval, traditional retrieval, after you do this, they also try to after they generate the index terms, either manually or semi-manually, they also look for other words that are synonyms for the words, and then basically to do the analysis of synonyms. They can also look for, so one of the things is that if you just look at the indexing based on this kind of an approach, then if a document contains one word and the query is another word that is a complete synonym of this, you won't bring that document out. Okay, that's something, those are basically, in this picture, we call them query operations. The idea then is that if I'm looking for word W, then I'll also throw in word W dash, because I assume W dash is synonym to W. And then I'll get you more results. Now, by the way, one interesting thing, since, you know, putting together everything that we are doing, for each of these boxes, in fact, several of these boxes, you can ask yourself, especially these boxes, when I do, I mean, I have a choice of removing stop words or not removing stop words. I have a choice of stemming or not stemming. I have a choice of manually indexing or indexing every possible word. What is the effect of each of these choices on what should I care about? If I have a choice in designing an information retrieval system, ultimately I should care about its effect on speed, of course, and precision and recall. So ask yourself, for each of these boxes, what gets affected? Okay? For example, stop words, what happens? If I remove stop words, what happens? Is the precision increased or reduced? Is the recall increased or reduced? So you got the answer, right? Everybody said at the same time, but there's strength in numbers. So if you do stop word analysis, why are you doing stop word analysis? Basically, hopefully, to increase the recall. Okay, because you know, if there was there's supposed to be, you know, like I wrote this query. I wrote the query, and I don't use, you know, if you're from India, you don't have any clue as to how to use articles in English. I don't have anyway. Okay, and so I ignore all the articles. Okay, and then basically, if I ignore the articles and then the document has the articles, then they won't be as good of a match, depending on, you know, how you match. Okay, so one of the things you're doing is when you remove the stop words, then in essence, you can increase the number of documents that come to you. Okay, you can argue these kind of things for each of these operations. What is the effect of each of these ideas on precision and recall? There is never any clean answer. Sometimes, you know, you can make both cases, that actually both precision increases and reduces, and recall increases and reduces. But ultimately, the reason you do this, you have to care about not just the speed, but what happens to the precision and recall. Okay? Here is a little example for stemming and stop word elimination. So here's a sentence in a document. The number of web pages on the World Wide Web was estimated to be over 800 million in 1999. And so if I do stop word elimination, normally most of the articles and common words will go away. Okay, all the red ones are gone. Okay, and then if I now do stemming, in fact, estimated will become estimate. Okay, in fact, depending on the stemmer, pages will become page. Okay, and that's the words that you would start with as the basis for noun phrase detection and manual indexing. Okay, so here's the question, since you guys use search engines, do you think your favorite search engine is using stemming? Yeah? Really?
I think that you can use stemming for...
Here's the deal, how do I tell? How do I tell whether or not my favorite search engine is using stemming? If I ask for used car, and if it gives me most queries, most answers which are about just used car and not mostly used car, that's a way you can tell.
Or compare with another query where you put used car.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. What? That's a good point. That's why, I mean, I'm not saying, in fact, you know, Google won't tell you what they're doing. I mean, you know, and no search engine will tell you what they're doing. But the point is, if you go and try, tonight you can try, you know, you can, I guess, use Chrome now and then do the real Google search. I got mine already. And So then basically they do use some stemming, but mostly most search engines don't use stemming at all. How about stop word elimination? Do they use only common stop words, or are there any uncommon stop words that people in, you know, English language don't necessarily think it's a stop word, but Google thinks it's a stop word? Remember that, see, these stop words, even if you didn't know anything about computer science and internet and web, these are all stop words. Just English language, ever since Shakespeare, these were stop words. Okay? But how about dub? How about web? Web is not a stop word at the Shakespeare's time, but web is almost a stop word. In many searches, in fact, if you try to put web, I don't know whether Google still does it, but at some point of time they would say, you know, www is too common a word, we'll remove it. Okay, web is too common a word, we'll remove it. So again, stop wordness is just, in fact, stop wordness, statistically speaking, is just a property of the document corpus. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if you have, you know, 15,000 documents written by people from India and two written by, you know, a couple of people from Tempe, then you better not remove articles, because that's the way you can tell which documents are written by who. Okay, most Indians don't write articles, or they write it wrongly. Okay, and I just say it because I'm an Indian, and you can yell at me later. But, you know, so there it becomes an important distinction between classes of documents. Okay, and it's just because the corpus has that thing. Whereas if you take a uniform distribution from just Tempe, you know, articles are useless. There was a reason. Yes, sir.
How do like expressions, like Boolean expression
words, like and, or not, how does it parse through those? That's a good question. So in fact, disjunctions, conjunctions, etc., we will see in a minute. Actually, again, this is one little thing you can do. It's a, you know, if you want to do experiments, I mean, normally we don't have a chemistry experiment set for this class, but you have search engine experiment you can do. I mean, as long as you're not doing it right now with your laptop, you can go home and check, okay? But, you know, the special words and, for example, depending on how you use it, in fact, you know, Google allows and, but not in the normal and. I mean, if you want the Boolean and, you need to use the plus and, plus. Okay, so why doesn't, this is all I said just now, why don't search, maybe I didn't say it, why don't search engines do much text talks? One major reason for doing text talks is that it's a way of dealing with computational limitations. You have to understand that, okay? Originally, it was done because you remove a large number of words and you only pick a few words to index, the index will be small. Okay, in traditional library, they can't build this, you know, pull cart catalogs which will go forever and ever. So they had to cut down some of the index words. Okay, that's not as much of a problem these days. We have enough computational power, so we can index everything. Okay, there is no reason from the point of view of speed not to index all words. So then the question becomes, is it going to improve precision? Is it going to improve recall? If so, I might consider doing it. If not, I'm not going to do it. Now the problem for that second question is that yes for some users and no for other users. And yes for some users some of the time, and no for other users, I mean no for same users other of the time. Okay, sometimes I'm looking for any use case. In some other times, I'm looking exactly for used case. Okay, now obviously in most search engines, you can put, if you want it to stop doing any extra operations on your query terms, you can put quotes. But just putting quotes doesn't help. If in fact all the occurrences of used were converted to use originally, right, then putting quote around used will give you zero documents. Because nobody in my corpus said used, because they're all gone. Okay, so in essence, most search engines, you can assume, actually index everything, every word. Okay, they may do text operations to stem, etc., at the query time, but they don't actually do it for reducing the indexing space or indexing time. Okay, that's an interesting thing to do. Okay, that's the main reason why text operations is not as big a deal in search engines. Okay, so if you go back to this picture here, here's a bunch of things, and by the way, each of these would be like a separate chapter in a traditional information retrieval book. I'll talk about text operations, I'll talk about stemming, and you will be told about Porter stemmer and all that fun stuff. But we'll skip over it because for search engines point of view, it's not important. Okay, not as important anyway. Okay, so then we'll come to ranking. So presumably you got a bunch of documents which seem to have the keywords that you're looking for. Okay, you use the inverted index to pick those documents. Now you need to rank them. The question is, how do you rank them? Okay, and which of these documents are you going to go to give to the user? That's the basic idea. Okay, so there are the interesting thing, of course, is in doing the ranking is, again, I'm repeating this from last time, you can't design ranking metrics without knowing the user, without knowing what it is that they're looking for. But you are being forced to design one ranking metric without knowing the user. Okay, so you're being asked to do the impossible. Okay, so we hypothesize what might be underlying the user's relevance judgment. Okay, we just hypothesize that. And the hypothesis would be that whatever is this judgment, this relevance function R, it would depend in some form on similarity of words, similarity of co-citation, and popularity of the document, and so on and so forth. And for each of these hypotheses, I can come up with a rank. Okay, and then we just hope that the hypotheses are right. And then we talked about the So in a way, in looking at the ranking, I want you to keep in mind what you must do versus what you can do. Okay? So what you must do, what you really want, is relevance of the document D with respect to the user and the given query, as well as the other documents they have seen. Since that's hard to do, we try to hope to get by similarity between the document D and the query Q, and to heck with the user and the relevance. We just made a hypothesis and said your relevance is based on this. Okay, and then in terms of this part, actually we won't even talk about it in the beginning, but search engines do use it in some greedy way, which is after you get the first document that's most similar, then the second document that you're looking for, you will try to get it not only in terms of similarity but the distance from the first document. Okay, it makes the ranking hard, but that's to the extent there is diversity in the results. Okay, that's the only reason that happens. Okay, there are other ways of getting to this. We'll see that if you have a huge number of results, all of them are relevant, you can cluster the results into K clusters. And we'll talk about why, how to do the clustering. And then you can give one representative from each cluster. That will ensure that there is diversity in the results. That's another way. Okay, but the big assumption you're making, of course, is the relevance of the user is somehow dependent on some hypothesis you made, which is the similarity between the words. Okay, and there are bunches of models for defining this relevance function, syntactically, but we'll really look at only two. Okay, one sort of today, and the other, which is more useful one that everybody uses currently too, that's starting today and next class too. Okay. So one is obviously the simple idea of Boolean measures, Boolean retrieval, and the second is vector space retrieval. Okay, one is based on a document as a conjunction of words. So a document really is a big propositional conjunction. Each word is a proposition name, and a document is a big conjunction of these propositions. And each query then is a propositional sentence. And you want to check if this propositional sentence evaluates to true in the conjunctive world defined by the document. That's what Boolean retrieval does. Okay? And the second model assumes that the document is a bag of words, and the bags can be represented as bags or vectors, and then that's stuff with that. We'll get there in a minute. Okay? A couple of things. Before we go there, even having decided that we'll just go with similarity between the words in the query and words in the document, you know, how much ever silly it might be, you think the specific method you use should have some reasonable properties. So For example, you would think that the partial matches should be allowed. That means if I have 15 words in my query, and if there's a document that has 14 of them but doesn't have one, you should probably consider that as a possible answer. You can't just cut it out, because there are enough reasons why that might still be irrelevant for a result. Okay. Weighted matches should be allowed. So for example, if there are 15 word query and there are two documents which both have 14 of those 15 words, okay, document one is missing the query word the, and document two is missing the query word computer. You should be able to say that document two is much worse than document one, because document one is missing a word that's not all that important. It's a part of the query, but it's like everywhere. Okay, so you need to be able to take into account the way, you know, the importance of the query words in checking. Okay, part of what we will be doing, of course. So again, in this case, I said if the query is red sponge, and then the document has red versus a document that has word sponge. In normal English, I would think in a normal document corpus, I would think that a document which has red but not sponge is not as useful as a document which has sponge but not red. But if your corpus is about sponges, right, it's opposite. If the corpus is about sponges, then the document which has sponge is useless, because everybody has one. Okay, and what you need is the word red, and so that becomes important. So in fact, the importance of the word is sort of dynamically decided in terms of the corpus. Okay, since one thing that we will do is, since we can't really, we are not supposed to know anything about the user in the traditional model, you're not doing much of a, you know, interaction with the user, then the thing that you can do is to look at the document corpus itself and look at its statistical properties in trying to improve the retrieval. Okay, and then the last thing, of course, is the relevance and the similarity probably should not depend too much on just the size of the document. So for example, so you have a document which says, you're looking for the query computer science, and one guy's thing has computer science, another guy's thing has computer science, so many times, right? So you don't want to say that the second one is always better than the first one. A little better, because obviously this person cares more about computer science, but clearly the size of the document should not matter as much. Okay, but you should be careful about it. You know, if a document which only has, 100 words, okay, of which 50 are computer, 50 are science. Another document which has 100 words, one is computer, one is science, the other is some other stuff. Clearly, I would think the first document, vacuous as it might be, is more relevant to computer science. So in a way, you want to consider the distribution of the query words relative to the documents, you know, rather than consider the document size itself. So you have to think of some normalization methods. Okay. Now, you can write other things, but these presumably you won't disagree with me as possible defederator. Okay. And one thing you can see, notice that this is the game of reduced expectations. We already got rid of the user. We already got rid of what it is that the user wants. And now we are trying to optimize with respect to these made-up metrics. These are necessary but not sufficient conditions for good retrieval. Sort of necessary, but definitely not sufficient conditions for good retrieval. Okay, and so now you'll see that as we look at the two ranking models, you'll see Boolean, for example, doesn't allow normally any partial matches. Okay, vector ranking and bag of words model does allow partial ranking. You can deal with the importance of words in multiple ways. In particular, the bag of words model, we'll see that you can look at how important a word is in terms of how many times it appears in the document itself, as well as how common is it across the documents. Okay, one is called the term frequency measure. How frequent is this term in the single document you are looking at? And the other is inverse document frequency. If everybody has this word, the fact that you have 100 of them is useless. Okay, so you can actually make sense of, you know, the IDF as sort of an information content of that word. The fact that that word is present in this document, does it tell you something about this document? previously I told you that if the corpus is made up of, you know, most of them, normally if the corpus is made up of randomly chosen documents from Tempi, the presence of an article in the document doesn't tell you anything about the document. But it might tell you something if in fact it's a mixture of German and English documents. Right, then the would not be present in German. It would be present in English. Okay. So you could do this dynamically from the corpus level and measure importances of the individual words and use them as part of the ranking. And then this, it turns out that only the vector similarity metric that we'll talk about has this problem. It tends to care about the size of the document. Boolean doesn't, because A and B is the same as A and B. That's just the way logic goes. Right? So Boolean clearly doesn't care about the size. Bags do care, because bags, small bags, large bags, right? And so what you do is you normalize the bags. You normalize the vector to be unit vector in the direction of the bag, of the document. Okay? That will take care of the size problem. Okay, so this is just sort of what's going to happen today a little bit, and tomorrow, next class a little more. Okay, so in terms of Boolean model, as I said, think of document as a big conjunction of words. So every word in the dictionary is a proposition name. A document is a conjunction of propositions. It's a conjunctive sentence. Okay, and in fact, a document is a full word. So in fact, when you say that the word is present, then if the word isn't present in that conjunction, that means the negation of that is present. That means it's definitely not present in the document, because documents, you know, for those of you who remember the logic terminology, documents are the interpretations on the world. An interpretation basically is for every proposition you give truth, falsity values. Documents are not formulas, they are actual interpretations. Okay? And then a query is any propositional sentence, and then you are supposed to do, normally the way you check whether the query is true in the document is to use the Boolean logic rules to see whether or not, you know, under in that world this query is true. Okay, there are, that's cheap enough, because checking whether a sentence is true in a complete world is very cheap, even in logic. Okay, it's checking whether a sentence is true in a set of words which corresponds to a set of interpretations, that's the hard one. Okay, checking it in a single complete world is easy. But you want it even faster. If you want it even faster, what you could do is you can consider the query sentence in the DNF form. You know, for those of you who remember the propositional logic, you can write it in the conjunctive normal form or a disjunctive normal form. In a conjunctive normal form, essentially the sentence becomes a conjunction. Every logical sentence S becomes a conjunction of disjunctions. And so on. That's the CNF. Okay? And it's a canonical form. Every sentence can be put in CNF form. Okay? And similarly, you can also put every sentence into a DNF form. For those of you who remember, you never did any logic but know EEE 120, which all the computer science students had to take. One is sum of products, one is product of sums. Okay? So in this case, the DNF, you essentially are talking about disjunction of clauses. Each clause is a conjunction. A and not B and C, W and K, and so on. Okay? So each query then becomes essentially a disjunction of these templates. Then all you need to do, since each document is a big conjunction anyway, and checking if a big conjunction gives rise to a small conjunction is easy, right? So for example, the only way A and B and C and D entails A and D is because A is present and D is present. That's it. Very simple. Okay? So in essence, what you're doing is you're going to mask these onto the document and see if any of the maps match, in which case the query matches. If not, it doesn't. And you can do this efficiently. Okay? And you can write any arbitrarily complex propositional logic sentence to describe your query need. Okay, and you can do this, and then the system can do this. Okay, these are the Boolean operations normally. And so, and this is what just say, this one is basically saying what I just told you, which is when you're looking for the query similarity, the similarity is binary, either it is yes or it is no. And it's yes if any of the templates, so you can think of each of these as the templates of the query, if any of the templates hold in the document, it's yes. If not, it's no. And you're supposed to just give all the documents that are ones, that are yes. Okay. The advantage of Boolean retrieval is that you can specify pretty complicated queries. If you know what you want, you can write them. And if you know Boolean logic, you can write them. Okay. It's much more interesting queries can be written than simple keyword queries. But of course, the disadvantage, so in fact, even though Boolean queries aren't really used by most of you guys probably, it's still used in some very specific context. So for example, this book, the IR book that you can, that I mentioned, actually talks about a law search engine which lawyers use to figure out, you know, whether there is a case which has, which talks about the problem that my client is having. Because law is a great precedence-based field. So if the judge by mistake said yes to the client once, then in all perpetuity they will be forced to say yes to similar clients. So all you need to say is, look, my client is similar to that old client, and so you should say yes. Okay? And so they're looking for this. Now they can look for very complex queries. Okay? And so for example, here are some examples. So this information need apparently is information on the legal theories involved in preventing the disclosure of trade secrets by employees formerly employed by a competing company, right? And so they represent this query as a trade secret and an operation disclose, an operation and prevent employee, where the S operation means it's in the same sentence. So this is kind of a proximity. It's sort of little more than simple Boolean. Basically, it's saying the word should be in the same sentence. Okay, it cannot be that the word is in one place and the second word is some other place completely far away. Or in the P means it's in the same paragraph. And K means it's within K words of the previous query. Okay, so they actually can do these kind of queries. And if you give this query, then the system will return only those documents that are relevant to this query. Okay, now this should look like SQL queries. If you write the right SQL query, you'll get the right answers. Because for every query, there is exact set of answers. And if you didn't get the right answers, it's not because the database is wrong, but because you are wrong. You didn't learn SQL. Now, you know, yelling at users would work if you're paying the user. Right, you know, databases used to be run by database managers, or, you know, there would always be somebody between the database and you. Okay, travel agents will look at Sabre database, or some other people will look at some other database, and they're being paid. And so if they screw up and they didn't ask the right answer, right question, you can fire them. If you tell people coming to a search engine, you ask for the wrong query, that's why you're getting the wrong results, then they just say, well, we'll go to some other search engine, which will guess our mind and do the right thing. Okay, so the problem in this is, while in fact, this model obviously is much more interesting and allows more complex queries than simple keyword search model. Okay, it also, the conversion of this information need to this query is being done by who? The user. So unless you provide for each user a front end in front of the database who listens to this and writes this query, which gives lots of people lots of jobs, but that's not what computer scientists are supposed to be doing. It basically, you know, you would have a very strong query, you make a very complex formal query, it could be completely wrong. It's not what I'm looking for. So I will give exact answers to the wrong query. Is that any better than getting, you know, some answers for wrongly expressed query? Partially expressed query, okay? So in fact, the textbook talks about the fact that there have been tests done where they have shown that people, you know, when they did the blind studies, where they actually allowed people to look for what they want using these complex queries, the people being lawyers, okay, and also ask them to search using keyword queries, okay, and then compare the results. They found that, in fact, keyword queries, while it is supposed to be simplistic, were better in getting what they wanted. Okay, so that's an interesting point. That means if you don't understand full language, then once you convert into some artificial form, you know, some forms might be looking more precise, but they could actually be hard to get right. Okay. So anyway, the other thing, of course, is that the Boolean model is binary. It's either relevant or not relevant. There's no in-between. Okay, that's the normal way you would define Boolean model thing. So there is not much of a ranking of the document, and then the information need has to be translated into a Boolean expression, which most users find awkward. And you know, this is the reason why we like, you know, search engines, because you write, in fact, one of the advantages is you can write this entire sentence into a search engine query box. And this is like we talking to dogs, right? We give nice stories, you know, this is what happened in my life, and then Farside has this beautiful cartoon where the dog sees it as blah, 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 Fido, blah, 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 Fido being the name of the dog. That's the only thing it actually gets. Everything else it's basically ignoring. Although I'm sure you have much smarter dogs and they understand a lot more. But generally, when you convert when you write this entire sentence into the keyword, the user may feel good, but essentially it's just a set of keywords, and you can do keyword search on that. Okay, so at least there's no conversion requirement, okay? So because Boolean thing allows precise queries and people can write imprecise queries, wrong queries, they are more unhappy oftentimes because they get either too few or too many answers, okay? Vector model is not necessarily better. It just annoys the user sometimes somewhat less. That's the important thing to understand. It's not that vector model somehow knows what the user is looking for. It's the game is to annoy the users less. Okay, and then vector models avoid annoying them a little more. Okay, so let's start talking about this. We still have 5 minutes, and we probably can complete the general idea of vector model today, and then we'll talk about it more again next class. So vector model assumes that each of the words is a dimension in a high-dimensional space. Each of the words in the document is a dimension in a high-dimensional space. And the number of times that word appears in that document is the value of that coordinate. That's it. Okay, so if you have my dictionary is 1 million words long, then every document is a 1 million word vector or a 1 million word bag. Okay, where the bag for each word, there can be multiple instances. And so the vector, the projection of the vector in that dimension corresponds to the number of times that word is present. Okay, now, what is the biggest thing that I said that should make you worry? The length of document, that's the computer science worry. For a while, let's forget about that, okay? There is this problem that now all these vectors are going to be sparse vectors. They're all very large vectors where most of them, hopefully, most of their dimensions have zero. That's okay, but what's the other issue? When you make each word to be a separate dimension in an n-dimensional space, you are saying all those dimensions are independent. In fact, one of the most important points about dimensions is the projection of y-axis onto the x-axis is zero. Projection of z-axis onto the y-axis is zero. Okay, what that means is the words are completely independently generated. So the fact that, so here is what I, you know, if you don't believe what I'm saying, okay, here, guess in a two-dimensional model, this is a two-dimensional model, x and y, okay? I'm going to give you, I have a point in mind, one point, okay, one coordinate point, okay? I'll make your life easy by giving you 50% of the answer away. The x happens to be 7. Can you guess why now? Why not? Because x doesn't tell you anything about y. why they are independent. Okay? Now, X is data, Y is structure. Okay? That's my sentence. That's my two-dimensional sphere. Now I will say I have a point in mind. It has data equal to 1. Do you think structure will be equal to 0 or 1 or 2 or 3? Which is more likely? You know more now, because data tends to go with structure, especially if you have computer science documents. So if you have computer science documents, data and structure are not independent dimensions at all. They are dependent dimensions. And however, you are making them look, at least when you are thinking of it as a vector in the n-dimensional space, you are assuming these are all orthogonal dimensions. Okay, that's a huge assumption, and we get by for a while, and then we'll try to modify it to see if we in fact can find a better orthonormal, better independent axis to define the same space. Okay, so in fact, to understand that, consider the following thing. Suppose I have suppose this board is the space I'm talking about, which is a two-dimensional space. I can have, this can be my y dash, this can be my x dash. I can use this as my coordinate system. Nothing stops me from doing it. And I can talk about every point in terms of these axes. The problem then is the coordinate axes are now no longer independent. So knowing x will tell you, x dash will tell you y dash. In fact, if you have a point here, it has certain projection. The projection of this axis onto this is not zero. Okay? What I would like to really do, in fact, what I should have done is make it like this. Okay, that's my axis. Okay, if I give you axis like this, if I could find for the same space these two axes, if I do it for you automatically, should be happier. Because these two axes define the exact same space. Every coordinate, every point in this space, which has coordinates, also has coordinates in this space. So it spans the same exact space, but this now is independent dimension. Okay? And so we will start looking at vector space model by looking at data being one dimension, structure being another dimension. And when you do data and structure in one those two dimensions, then they're more like this. They are essentially dependent on each other. And then we'll talk about how to modify the coordinates, how to modify the coordinate axis, how to reduce the dimensionality. That's the latent semantic indexing. And to some extent, what latent semantic indexing does can be seen as that. Okay, so we'll try to make sense of this independence assumption later on, okay, the lack of independence assumption. But once you do think of two documents as vectors in any random space, you can start talking about distances between vectors. And there are many distances, and one distance, I'll say this and you can get to go home. If I have two vectors, one distance is the Euclidean distance between the two points. That's one distance measure. In fact, there is nothing sacrosanct about a distance measure. A good distance measure, all it needs to do is, agree with the triangle law of inequality. Even if not, that's okay too. But, triangle law of inequality is a useful thing to have for distance measures. Okay? So, there is one distance measure, which is the Euclidean distance between those two points. Okay? Another distance measure, which is just some measure of this angle between those two vectors. And essentially, cosine theta metric, which corresponds to taking the dot product of these two vectors and normalizing it by the sizes of the two vectors, is that measure. Okay? That too has desirable properties. And in fact, it turns out that that has some advantage, extra advantages, because the angle doesn't depend upon the size of the vector. And I did mention that we should not be overly dependent on the size. So for example, I would like to be able to say that these two vectors are as similar as this vector and this vector. And obviously, if you think in terms of Euclidean distance, they are not. But in terms of angles, they are. Okay? So we will look at these distance measures, and we'll actually also try to convince ourselves empirically at least, that they seem to do something more reasonable. Okay, and then we'll go on to talk about importance, how to get it, you know, relative importance of the keywords differently by considering the term frequencies, document frequencies. So that's what we'll do next class.